Right now, I would like to welcome Ellen Zieselman. She is curator of education at the New Mexico Museum of Art, and we're here to talk about excavating Egypt, great discoveries from the Petrie Museum of Egyptian Archaeology at University College London. Welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Great to have you. This exhibit centers around the life and work of a man named William Matthew Flinders Petrie.
Sir William Matthew Flinders Petrie, yes.
Who was he?
Well, he was an interesting man who was born in the mid-1800s. He was actually ill as a child and self-taught largely. He was a collector of coins and interested in all things ancient, and hung out a lot at the British Museum, got a reader's ticket to the library at the British Museum when he was about 21. And when he was 26, he went to Egypt and spent the rest of his life. You know, he went to Egypt in 1880, and I think his last excavation was in 1942. And really just spent his life excavating in Egypt and what today is Israel and the Palestinian territories.
So, when we look at archaeological museums and exhibitions that go back that far, you sort of forget that the study of archaeology itself is not nearly as ancient as the objects we're looking at. This is really a late 19th century phenomenon.
It is indeed. And one of the things that Petrie is really credited with is coming up with standards and practices that today archaeologists still follow. He's known as the father of Egyptian archaeology, and he was really one of the first to recognize the value of finding objects in their entire context and having as much context as possible for an object. Apparently, before he went there, people were just digging up big things and selling them because people were interested in them, and he really found the value in small fragments and in everyday objects and things that were just, you know, most of the big pot hunters, if you will, were leaving behind.
Well, there's an amazing moment in the essay about him in the museum catalog where he talks about how unfortunate it is when we walk in our heavy boots and crunch on the pottery under our feet. And you just cringe. I mean, no modern archaeologist would ever set foot on fragments of pottery.
Right, and yet this was sort of happening. I mean, there's this other quote he writes in a letter when he lived in a tomb, an empty tomb, when he first got there in 1880. And he does mention to his parents that there was this better tomb that, you know, was better situated, but he would have to dig out all the bones and dirt and, you know, stuff, you know, clear it out before he could move in, so it's not worth the time, so he lives in this other one.
Why did he live in a tomb?
I think it was free. I think it was pretty cheap. I think he was...
Didn't have a commute to work, I suppose.
He didn't have a commute to work. He was a very efficient guy, and he worked, you know, there are quotes about him working in his underwear, which would keep local, you know, sort of rubberneckers away. And
well, it was so hot also.
Exactly. And, you know, I think when they say underwear, they do mean like the full length, you know, union suit.
No. That's right. And if he wore pink underwear, then it really kept people away because they thought he was strange.
Right. They didn't know what to make of him.
Which he was.
He was a bit of an odd duck, but, you know, I guess sometimes that's what it takes to be a visionary.
So he went to Egypt, and what kinds of objects was he taking out? Was he piecing together fragments of broken things? Was he looking for intact things? What kind of things did he find, and in fact, during this exhibition?
Well, you know, it seems some of everything, and there are definitely some large finds that he would have, mainly because he there was a deal where, you know, the Egyptians weren't completely unaware of what was there, and so there was a head of Egyptian antiquities, and they had a ratio, I think it was 2/3 to 1/3, that the Egyptians got the first pick, and they got to take 2/3 of what he found, and he was able to keep others. And he kept some large things to sell to collectors to fund his future excavations. And he himself seemed to collect a lot of smaller things. Sometimes they were fragments that he pieced together. Sometimes they were just fragments that he saw value in. And this exhibit is filled with really wonderfully small, intimate, everyday objects. And some things, like there's a piece of pottery or stone fragment that has looks like a sketch of Nefertiti from the Amarna site. And just things like, you know, he saw that that artists, just like artists in our own day, would make a sketch before they would commit something to the wall. And so these little fragments that have little faces on them seem to be that.
Are they ever correlated with big works that have remained?
I think they are, but I Not an Egyptologist myself, I don't know that specifically.
We're talking about the exhibition Excavating Egypt, which is at the New Mexico Museum of Art. Let's talk more about this question of context. He was the father of Egyptian archaeology, and his great contribution was finding things in context, which we've talked about on this program before in the context of the archaeological sites that are being looted in Iraq and the tremendous amount of knowledge that's being lost because things are being taken out of context.
Right.
What does context tell you, and what kind of context did this man Petrie find?
Well, you know, in general, and archaeologists of all stripes will tell you that, you know, you can't just look at a vessel, say, and have any real sense of what its use was, or, you know, the best you can do is surmise. I mean, I think a lot of that comes, you know, Mimbres pottery, for example, we have some ideas maybe of what they were used for, but oftentimes, you know, they're just ended up in collections because somebody found them in their backyard and didn't do a big archaeological dig or pot hunted or whatever. Context, it's the ability to know where in a room, for example, something was found, what other objects were found with that object. There's a set of objects in this exhibit. There's a necklace and a bead and a ring that were all found on in the same burial, and we knew, you know, Petrie left evidence of where they were found, you know, that the necklace was found around the neck of the body, and the ring was on the finger of the body, and that, you know, there's wear on the ring, and so you have a sense that it wasn't just made for the burial, but it was really something perhaps that this woman really used in life and enjoyed. And the little vessels that are part of it, you know, even though they're broken, even the fact that they're broken gives you an idea of how they were made on the inside, because you can really see that they were carved out of this calcite, this Egyptian alabaster. So, you know, context just gives you a broader picture of the culture itself and the whole, you know, how objects were used rather than just that they were created.
Are all the objects that are in this collection objects that were found in tombs?
A large majority of them are, and apparently the Egyptian culture was very much interested in preserving the life that they had during life, and that their concept of afterlife was you just sort of kept living, only in a different state. And so the portraits on the mummy cases were a way for your soul, once it had been judged favorably, to come back to find your body, because, you know, they would have a picture. And the objects that were left behind were things that the person had used in life and would want to keep using after death. And one of the greatest sources of Egyptian everyday life of a certain class, mainly an upper class, is paintings, tomb paintings, which are not in this exhibit because they're too large and on the walls of tombs. But the tomb paintings, which really show these activities that they had been participating in and would want to keep doing in the afterlife.
What kinds of people got entombed? Presumably not everybody.
Well, you know, it's a strange thing. Not everybody, for sure, although the earliest mummified bodies were the lowest classes of citizens, because what happened was they would just bury them in a hole in the sand in the desert, and that would, the heat in the desert and the sand would create all the
inadvertent mummies.
Exactly. And then a higher class started burying them in boxes, and the bodies were decomposing, and so they had to create the concept of mummification to replicate what had been happening in these, you know, just pits. And there are definitely the afterlife was certainly reserved for upper classes, and in earlier periods, just the pharaoh and priest class, and then later, as I understand it, they were the upper class, the nobility also got in on the act.
A question that always comes up for me with this question of tombs and knowing about a culture through tombs is, you know, if I go to a New Mexico cemetery and I see the tombstones there and the things that people leave, how much could I really tell about the way we live our daily lives here in New Mexico? Is it analogous there? Do you know how much we can tell and really what is missing from the jigsaw puzzle of Egyptian life?
You know, you never know. And, you know, I think about, like, the ancient Greeks and Romans, and we have some text from them, you know, we have these plays and things like that, but what if, you know, what if we're missing a whole bunch the other side of the story, for example. I often think that if
the stuff the women wrote, for example.
Well, that would be one. Or, in our own culture, what if you only had, the Washington Times as your, source of what
right.
our
the
culture
whole, the
was.
The whole archive survives.
The whole archive of the Washington Times survives, and it would be an accurate record on the one hand, and yet we'd be missing a whole lot of nuance about our society. And so I'm sure that that's true with ancient cultures. What's fascinating, though, is how much we can glean from what has been found, and really how humanity hasn't really changed drastically. And I think this is a good thing. Humanity hasn't, they weren't these alien species 5,000 years ago, that we're still pretty much who we are.
And certainly not primitive when you look at this exhibition.
Absolutely not primitive. I mean, the things that they were carving and crafting and creating for themselves to make their lives more beautiful and more adorned and more interesting are they're phenomenally created objects. And to, they didn't have half the technology that we think of as necessary for life, and yet not at all a primitive society, very advanced.
And the visual culture and the visual objects that remain are incredible. There's one of the things that's striking in the show, just a little thing, but there's weights that a scale with a balance on each side, but the little weights that go on the scale are carved in the shape of really incredible little animals.
Right, there's a hippo weight stone, and then there's a calf weight made out of metal, and you're right. I mean, they were using simple weights, and balance scales to conduct their business, and
but the hippo was 10 grams and the whatever.
Right, they definitely had specific weights, and they knew exactly what they were doing, and they could have just used a lump of stone to do that, or a lump of metal, but they took the time to carve them and make them interesting, and just like we do with things that we use every day, like bunny slippers, for example.
Which probably will not survive the next five
Sadly,
millennia.
Sadly, they may not, although photographs of them may, which will really puzzle archaeologists in the future.
They might think we were a subspecies of ourselves. We're talking to Ellen Zieselman, Curator of Education at the New Mexico Museum of Art, about Excavating Egypt, the exhibition which is on view until the 6th of January of this coming year. What were Sir William Matthew Flinders Petrie's favorite objects?
Oh, I think he loved them all equally, but that's because I have no idea. And my favorite objects in the exhibit are a pair of tweezers and a little bronze razor that are metal. There's some little iron plates that are like half an inch big at best, little squares, and they were apparently put as like chainmail, as armor. There's a little vase that probably held perfumed oils that is on its side because one of its handles, it's shaped like a swan, and it's just beautiful. There's a piece of papyrus, a fragment from the Book of the Dead, that's just, you really get to see how similar papyrus is to paper, but really how different as well, that it's really just this bark, and yet the writing on it that's 3,000 years old is just phenomenally beautiful and elegant and everything that a beautiful text would have today. There's just such a variety of objects, and there's objects from every period and just about every place in ancient Egyptian history, and you just get a real intimate one-to-one, these objects which you could hold in your hand, someone held in their hand 3,000 years ago.
The timeline of the exhibition in terms of the objects in it is 4800 BC to 138 AD. That's nearly five millennia.
Right.
And what's funny is, five millennia, our country is 200 years old. We think of ourselves probably, maybe, as one century old, because our collective memory doesn't even extend back very far.
Right.
And then we think of Egypt as one thing over 5,000 years. It's
not
so many things over not only great time, but a great geographical span.
Right, and there's different periods. There's the Akhenaten period in Amarna, where he decided he was a pharaoh, and he decided that instead of this polytheistic society, it was just going to be monotheistic, and he destroyed some objects and created this whole artistic style that's different. His wife was Nefertiti. And he precedes,
same conflicts we have throughout history.
Always. There's always a struggle between, you know, wanting to be different and wanting to shift visually. And
monotheism and polytheism.
Exactly. Excuse me. And the other thing that's fascinating is that you can see, that you can really see in some of these objects how the Romans influenced things when they came in at the very end of the ancient Egyptian period. Think about Antony and Cleopatra, that time period. And the portraits become much more representational and individualized and very Roman looking. There's an encaustic paint panel of a Roman, and then there's also this curious little limestone sculpture that really just looks like, you know, he does not look Egyptian, he looks Roman. He's just, you know, kind of have this totally different expression on his face. The earliest period is there, the Old Kingdom, the influence that they were involved with Greeks way back in the Attic period. We've got these little fragments of vases that just are Greek vases, and so we know there was some connection there in the different places. And then, you know, there's also just the mundane everyday. There's a rat trap from the site of Lahoon, where
I love that.
You just realize that these people were just living like we do today. They were dealing with the elements and nature and everything else.
Let's go back to Petrie for a moment. There's this whole question of, I mean, he was allowed to take one third of the objects that he found out of Egypt, but were there politics on what he took out and the fact that he was establishing a museum in England?
I imagine there were, but I'm not positive. And I think a lot of that shifted in the 20s when Howard Carter found Tut's tomb, and then I think there were some issues about superstardust and things like that. And Petrie actually stopped excavating in Egypt after Howard Carter and the whole Tut phenomenon. It just wasn't the same place for him. And
why did he stop?
I think, and I haven't done a whole lot of research into this, but my understanding is that he was, I think he just thought that there was a purity that was lost. And so he just wasn't really, you know, I don't think he was interested in getting drawn into this whole celebrity archaeologist thing.
And so when King Tut's tomb was found, it was like a giant blockbuster as much then as it is now?
Yeah, I think it was. And because I think it was found so completely intact, and he had been doing all this excruciating work, you know, I imagine he had been doing all this excruciating work to figure out things from like the tiniest of fragments of things that had already been looted in the past, and here's this like, you know, entirety. And apparently the things that they found whole chariots. They found whole, you know, it was just absolutely intact, and there's so much. It was just this phenomenal draw. Even today, you know, we know if you go to the Cairo Museum, I think there's two floors of things they found from King Tut's tomb. So there's a lot, and I think Petrie liked his sort of piecing together the loner archaeologist, and so he chose to go to. You know, he went over to what's today Israel and Palestine and that area and excavate there because nobody was doing anything there. And he did some really interesting and important work for about the last 20 years of his life there.
So this Petrie Museum is in London, and the objects are traveling. This is a traveling exhibition. It's going to lots of different places.
Right. This was organized by the Carlos Museum at Emory University by a curator there named Peter Lacavara, and he put it all together with the Petrie Museum, and it's an important way to get their objects out into the known world. These are the kind of objects that most museums that have large Egyptian collections have like shelves and shelves and shelves of. And so if you were to go to, say, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is a wonderful Egyptian collection, you might see some of these similar objects, but they, you know, you get overwhelmed by them because there are 1,000 of them in a room. And in our collection,
and probably a lot of them are in the vaults where you don't even see
them.
Well,
yeah, exactly. Or they do stick them all out on these sort of, you know, exposed, you know, collection storage shelving where they're just on shelves and you can see them, but they're hundreds at a time. And this is an exhibit of about 220 objects. And it's really elegantly displayed, and you know, our galleries we're doing, you know, a good business, but we're never going to be jam-packed like the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
And I find that the thing that's, maybe this is just my subjective thing, but the projecting yourself into the lives of the people who, as you said, who held these things in your hand, there's a scope for opportunity in that you don't usually find in museum exhibitions.
It's true, and there's really a way to, you get this up close and personal, intimate look at Egyptian daily life, and it makes it very, very, takes this ancient, mysterious, monumental culture and puts it in a very human scale.
Ellen Zeisselman, thank you so much for being with us here in the cafe.
Well, thanks for having me.